we look at the features of a business and we say, right, these, some of them may or may not become international, but they have no inherent advantage in doing so. When they go to a new country, they're not halfway there the day they arrive.
Hey folks, it's Cynthia Dearen here. Welcome to Business Beyond Borders, where I unlock the secrets of international business success. For many companies looking to scale internationally, funding the expansion is one of the biggest challenges that they face. Without a strong track record, it can be pretty hard to convince banks and financial institutions to back an international venture. And in lots of places, finance is just downright hard to come by, especially if you're small. Today, I'm talking to angel and startup investor Les Sekely. Les is an expert when it comes to investing in companies scaling internationally. He's been active in the investment space since 1999, and these days he's focused full-time on startup investing. Before that, Les just happened to be one of Australia's leading tax advisors, and he's lectured extensively and authored over a dozen books on tax planning, investment, and cross-border structuring. But today, Les runs EVP funds, in other words, early stage venture funds. He's a director and a shareholder in a long list of companies, including Alternative Media, Resdy, OneFlare, ShipIt, SnapRevise, Uptick, DesignCrowd, Blue Thumb, and a bunch of others. He's also the chairman of the ASX-listed Microequities Asset Management and a director of not-for-profit group 40K. Welcome to the show. It's great to have you here today.
Hello. It's great to be with you.
So my first question is, how did you get into investing?
I actually got rather lucky, I think. I had a loose social relationship with a gentleman called Leon Kamenev, who approached me back in 1999, I think it was, about starting a particular online business. He wanted advice from a professional firm where I was a partner at the time, no experience in startups. I became very engrossed with that, helped him develop a business plan and spreadsheets and projections on an old thing called Lotus 1-2-3 that some of your older listeners may be aware of. And we got our information memorandum ready for a capital raising. I can't remember, it was 2 days before or after the dot-com bubble popped, so back in 2000. As a result of that, what would have been a $5 million raise on a valuation of $10 million was something you could not give away. I'd become so engaged with Leon, putting huge hours working with him, that I basically told him, I will back you and invest myself and continue to, not $5 million, but a much smaller amount. But I will continue to work with you and back you, because by then I believed in what I was selling, so I bought it myself. And that's how it started in 1999, 2000.
That's amazing. And just give me a sense of where it went to after that, because today that's pretty much what you do, isn't it? You invest.
Yeah, it was a business called Hotel Club, and I learned a great deal working with Leon and what's turned out to be a fantastic team of people. All our senior people have done large startups of their own or taken very senior roles in big corporates since then. But that business grew at literally an exponential rate. The business called Hotel Club, and was sold in 2004 to one of the mythical US mega companies. I was very lucky in my first run and lucky with the people I worked with.
And so today, in your current business, what kind of companies do you typically work with?
Okay, look, I wear two hats. Personally, I'm an angel investor, which means I'll invest in... Well, I have one rule. I only invest in a company once it's generating some revenues, but very early stage for me personally. Investments $200,000 or $300,000, a little bit more maybe as a first investment. Generally with young founders, and by young I mean late 20s, early 30s, who have gotten started, are up and running. Often the team is only three or four people. And I back them. I look for things where I can actually help add value, bring a bit of experience to the table. And then that's my personal portfolio and what I do in my private capacity. Wearing another hat, I'm the chairman of the investment committee for a venture capital fund. It's called Equity Venture Partners. We've actually got two funds. One's a $25 million fund. The other's a $35 million fund, which we're still investing. And there we, our mandate is to invest in companies that have got, or that are looking for a check size of between 500,000 and 5 million. So usually we'll put in 1 or 2 million and then follow on if it's gone the right way. And I guess the other thing I can add is we really have ended up a little bit of a specialisation in digital businesses, and in particular B2B, business-to-business software as a service, and also some online two-sided marketplaces.
Yeah. And this show, as you know, is all about businesses going global. In your experience, which are the kind of companies, in your opinion, that have the most potential to scale internationally and to become companies with a global reach? Is it only tech companies, or do you think that non-companies that use tech to reach their market can also succeed in that global space?
Well, let me divide your question into two parts, maybe, because there are two aspects to this. One is a global business in the sense that you sell globally and have customers around the world. The other is you might be a local company, but you may have staff and internal operations spread across the world. And I think, both sides of that discussion are very, very interesting. But assuming you want to talk first about companies that are expanding internationally, we as an investment fund, tend to look at them in three categories. There are those businesses which by their nature are highly likely to ever outgrow Australia because their product or service is of a type that gives them no head start if they were to go overseas. So by way of example, we invested in one company called Lumery, which provides a software, the NDIS, National Disability Insurance Scheme, the people that manage that and work in that. There's a lot of red tape and bureaucracy about monitoring the needs of people on NDIS and managing their budget and getting payments authorised and multiple different types of service providers from cleaners to physiotherapists to medical. So Lumery handles that. It's very sophisticated. It's having great success in Australia, but a big portion of their software is based on government regulation, regulatory compliance. So it would have to be a major engineering to go offshore. And likewise, most of its customers would be national, not international organisations. So again, for that reason, it wouldn't have an inherent head start offshore. So we look at the features of a business and we say, right, some of them may or may not become international, but they have no inherent advantage in doing so. When they go to a new country, they're not halfway there the day they arrive. The next category are businesses that have a business model that could apply anywhere in the world, but relies on local customers and suppliers. So maybe the best, well, amongst the best known of those are things like Uber, where each city they go to, they've got to sign up drivers and sign up consumers because it's a very local two-sided marketplace. So in that sense, they've got they're a major international, but they do have to start each market in the early days from scratch. Later on, you develop branding and may you're known even in cities you haven't expanded to. But at the early stages we invest, each new city would be completely virgin territory. But the business model and the technology are highly transportable. So that's the second category, that those that can scale internationally, but do so by conquering one market at a time with some inherent advantage in the technology and business model transport. And then the third category are those that often from the first few weeks of trading have customers internationally. And that tends to be in the category of the business-to-business software as a service. So a good example there is one that I've been associated with for about 13 years, a business called SiteMinder. Had some press recently saying it's going to be the next Australian unicorn, but its business involves connecting hotels to the online resellers. People, the consuming public doesn't think about it. But when you book a hotel room online through something like bookings.com, the bookings.com computer usually is not talking direct to the computer in the individual hotel, because there are so many hotels and everyone's got a different computer system. So SiteMinder sits in the middle and it connects to, I think it's now in the low hundreds of hotel room resellers like bookings.com. And on the other side, there's closing in on 40,000 hotels that use the platform so that they can make their inventory available to all the resellers. Now, it's a bit of a long explanation, but it's about understanding the nature of the business. That business, from the time it was a few months old, had international customers. So even though for the first several years we only had staff and operations in Australia, we had hotels from all around the world that wanted to sign up to Australian channels like What If, for example. And likewise, we had Australian hotels that wanted to distribute through bookings.com and Agoda and so forth. So there are three profiles, and with some experience, you can look at a business and say, this is going to be, you know, almost certainly local only, Australian only. This one's got international potential, but it's hard yards, conquering one market at a time. And then there are other ones, from day one, they have customers all over the world.
And those are mainly in that SaaS space.
Well, that's overwhelmingly the most common, because once you get into, especially physical goods, you get involved in the whole issue of logistics and warehouse and shipping. So they tend to scale internationally nowhere near as well.
Yeah. So when you're looking at a company as a company that you might invest in, and you've decided which of these three categories that it's in, what else do you look for when you actually go about that process of assessing whether a company is right to invest in?
I mean, it's and remembering we're early stage investors, having the international potential is often a big plus, because one of the things that any investor or venture capitalist looks at is the total addressable market. Now, jargon is the TAM, total addressable market for that business. So something like SiteMinder, from a practical point of view, the market is unlimited. It's every hotel in the world and every hotel reseller in the world. On the other hand, something like Lumery, which may develop some international operations one day, but you don't take that into account, it's not in that likely category. You've got to assess the size of the Australian market and say, can this business get big enough, given that addressable market, to have the potential to give us the return on investment that we need for the high level of risk we take? So that's the first thing, where whether you're purely Australian or Southeast Asia or international in potential comes into working out your addressable market in the first instance. Interestingly, for those businesses that do have international potential, a little tip if you've got any sort of founders with you there. One of the things that puts me off, and I think puts a lot of VCs off, is that if at a very early stage, when you've yet to get any significant traction in the local market, you're selling the business on its global potential, that actually is a turn off.
Yeah.
You know, people who say they're going to climb Mount Everest when they haven't climbed the Katoomba, I think they do themselves a disservice in terms of credibility.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's just an observation from experience. Yeah. And then maybe the third thing is, obviously the track record and the extent you can assess it, the predisposition of the founders. So if they're people, we're talking about international, if they're people that have worked in businesses with an international footprint before, if they have an international orientation, they speak languages, that obviously gives you a clue as to how hard or easy it's going to be for them to develop a global footprint. And this is all on the side of whether your customers lie. There are other things you look for on the side of their ability to have business operations for customers globally.
Yeah. And in Australia, do you find that there are many founders who've got that international experience?
Yes, because there we now have, a lot of startups and companies that do have an international footprint. We get founders, for example, one of our founders was an ex-employee of Foodora, who has now gone on and started his own business. But, through that work experience, he obviously got major international exposure. He ran the Australian operation. It's a business called Eat Club. It's gone on to do something similar but different in the industry. Now, we invested in Eat Club on the basis that it had significant traction in Australia, and the founder was raising money to go off and launch in New York. We invested only about 5 or 6 months ago, and New York is up and running with the transaction stuff. So, yeah, you do get quite a bit of that international orientation. The other thing not to forget is Australia is a heavily migrant population. Such a large percentage of our population are either migrants or the children of migrants. So there's a lot of people that have got affinity for other countries and languages. Which is not to say the individual country or language is important. It's just they're open-minded that Australia is not the whole world.
Absolutely. I think that's a great point. Just talk to me about timing. Do you think that there is there a right time for a company to look at an international scale-up?
Look, again, that is very business-specific. If you go back maybe those three types of business I was talking about, the business where its suppliers and customers are local and its tech has got a heavy localization component, they probably shouldn't try anything international until they've gotten really large in Australia, until maybe they're heading towards a situation where acquiring more customers is getting more and more expensive. They're really large and can afford to go offshore, because it's a heavy startup cost, because they're not bringing much advantage with them. They've got neither suppliers nor customers, nor branding, nor the whole of the tech platform. So those should go generally quite late. The next ones are the ones that are more that Uber city by city model conquering. They should have a significant operation and footprint in Australia, where the process, the system, the metrics, the business hypothesis is proven and scaling. And then you go offshore. So, take the Uber example again. If you've got 4 or 5 or 6 of the Australian cities functioning, maybe one is getting quite mature and the others at various stages, that might be the time to go offshore and set up an office somewhere in Chicago or wherever and try another city in another country. And then the third category, like SiteMinder, those that have software as a service, as I say, they're often international. Yeah, from birth.
Yeah, yeah. So it really depends on, what type of company it is and what sector it's in.
Yeah. I mean, maybe to mention another one that using life cycle of an international, there's another business that our funders invested in heavily and I've invested in called Resdi, which is similar to SiteMinder. It's a digital electronic connector between tour and activity operators. So think about things like ridge climb, walking tours, maybe something like Zoo Tickets or Opera House walking tour. It provides a technology both to help the tour and activity providers to manage their inventory, to digitize it, so it's no longer an Excel or something like that. And it then also provides a technology once the inventory is digitized, you can then distribute through third-party channels. So companies like Viator and so on are begin distributing those tours and activities. It developed, again, it had international customers from the time it was a few months old, but it probably took about 4 years of growing and developing with a core footprint in Australia, and then typically New Zealand comes next. And we're probably about 4 years old before we first opened an office, in that case, again, in the US. Typically for reasons of language and culture and various business process after Australia, our experience is sort of, six out of 10 will go to the US, three out of 10 will go to the UK, and the other one, when they go international, could be anywhere, either based on a specific market or the background of the founder. Which is not to say that businesses like Resty weren't international from the time they're a few months old, in that we had people from all around the world signing up and becoming customers. But that's a different thing to being at the stage where you should positively market to offshore customers and then ultimately set up an office offshore.
If you're enjoying the Business Beyond Borders podcast and you're thinking about expanding your company internationally, check out the Dearen and Associates website, dearenassociates.com. Let's have a talk about pitching. I'm sure you see dozens of people every month coming through your door and pitching you ideas and saying, please invest in my company. Is there a formula for the perfect pitch?
If anyone had it, it would be worth a fortune. I don't believe there is a formula. There are a whole lot of common sense things that everyone should do, and some people do them well, some people do them badly. One of the things that really impresses me, again, bearing in mind that we're talking very early stage companies, they might have been trading for 3 months, 6 months, and in some cases when we first invest, I'm always mindful of how important the personality of the founder is. Mm. And to push that to the extreme, we've found it difficult investing with businesses that are founded by, when I say old, let's say 35 plus, 40 plus age entrepreneurs who have got a rich business background or professional background. We find it really difficult investing in those businesses if they are early stage. And that's because the founders have a, perhaps correct, the perception of self-worth and the worth of their idea, and they have a credibility and a contact network that translate to quite a high valuation. So if a founder is 45 and has a track record of success, whether he's been a partner of a law firm, an accounting firm, a consulting firm, whatever it is, run his own business at some scale, a person like that is unlikely to be pitching a business at a valuation of $2 or $3 million. They come in at a valuation of $8, $10, $15 million. And it's really difficult for us to do business with people like that. Never say never. I've had one or two good ones, but it's interesting. The identical business with that sort of founder, as opposed to a founder who's, he's got an accent, he didn't go to a private school, doesn't have a contact network, might be just as smart, just as hardworking. The identical business, the valuation might be a half or a third. So much depends on the founder's experience, contact network, self-confidence, and ability to sell. Because when you're raising capital, you are selling, and at a very early stage, you're selling mainly yourself because there isn't much else yet.
So let me ask you, if a 45-year-old founder came to you and gave you the same valuation that a 20-year-old founder had come along and presented for their company, would that change how you saw that founder?
Look, there's research, and one interesting thing about startups is that by now there's a fair bit of, I don't know if it's quite academic, some of it's academic, but semi-academic research and surveys on startups as an industry. And one of the findings, which is fairly widely come up from various studies, is that businesses with older founders tend to grow faster and scale more quickly. So it's not an anti-old person thing, but one of the things you do is if somebody age 45 comes in and is looking to raise $1 million, you do tend to ask the question to say, is he really successful? Does he really have a good track record? If not, question mark if you back him. If yes, why is it that he can't find money of his own to invest if it's only $1 million? Doesn't he have friends, family, business colleagues who will back him? So, it's complicated.
And I kind of asked that question as a kind of a devil's advocate question in case there are any 45-year-old founders, you know, who are thinking of coming to talk to you and want to know what they should do to get your attention. But let me go back. Again, yeah, go ahead.
It depends who they're talking to, but there's if you're talking to somebody like us, and many VC funds would ask that same question, I guess you need to have an answer.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Why aren't you backing yourself? Why can't you raise the money from your own contact network?
Yeah, and I think that's a great question. I think one of the answers might be that a lot of people are too afraid to ask because they don't like to ask their friends. Just go back to the formula for pitching again. What are some of the other things that you are looking for when people come to you to pitch? I mean, we've talked about the total addressable market. We've talked about what kind of valuation people put on the company. What else are you looking for when you, you know, when you interview somebody about their idea or their company?
Look, the founder, the chemistry with the founder is absolutely critical. I remember one time we were having a hard negotiation with a founder about the rights that we as a VC wanted to veto certain transactions. So related party transactions, significant expenditure outside of an approved budget. Because as a VC fund, you're coming as a minority shareholder. These are basically minority shareholder type protections. And we're having protracted discussion around this, and the person was worried about we're going to be controlling or obstructive. It's definitely not what we're on about. And I just pointed out to him, look, the day that money goes into your bank account, I don't see what comes out and where it goes. I'll get a monthly report, which I trust is correct, monthly board pack or something. But you have my money. If you disappear, if you're dishonest or unethical, I've got 100% risk. Your risk. But I might try to veto something which is actually in the interest of the business that I now have a share in. It's pretty darn small. Now, the reason I tell that anecdote, I actually have said that probably a couple of times to founders, is it's the VC that's taking the big risk, trusting the person you might have met 5, 6, 7 times over the space of 2, 3 months, effectively a stranger. So you're backing them. So that founder personality, your assessment of and gut feel about their competence, integrity, moral compass, level of motivation. It starts getting hard and they burn out and leave, you have nothing. So that is, can't overemphasize that. The next thing is the business model. And then the business model in our case, we'll only invest once there's revenue and the thing is up and running. We look really hard at metrics. We're heavily swayed by metrics. Again, being early stage, we make judgment calls on thin data, but generally we must have data, and the data must indicate that the thing can scale. And again, your listeners should be familiar with each jargon. We look at their channels for distribution, which is a two-sided marketplace, but securing both the supplier and the purchaser. We look at their channels. Do they look scalable? We look at their customer acquisition cost. Is it likely to go up or down? And is it sustainable? We look at the customer lifetime value, which often you have to guess a bit in the early stage. But with something like RESD, which will provide the software for, say, a whale watching boat operator, RESD digitizes an inventory of which boats are going out when, how many seats there are. It then allows you to sell those seats as a sort of ticketing off your own website or through third-party channels that manages your inventory and your customer data, that's going to be very, very sticky. It takes a fair bit of effort for people to implement that and get up and running and train their staff, and they're not going to leave in a hurry. So even if the business is 6 or 12 months old, say you've got a 12-month track record, and you can see that the churn is 5 or 6% in the first 12 months of the business, well, you know it's going to be a long customer lifetime value. Even if the data's not there. Customer lifetime value, payback period is important. What does it cost to sign up a customer? What does it cost all up? Your marketing costs, your sales costs, your cost of setting up onboarding training. What's the cost all up of acquiring the customer compared to their lifetime value? And what's the payback period? So you can have businesses that are, if they have a long customer lifetime value, take a 5-year customer lifetime value, you're getting typically the SaaS business monthly revenue for 5 years, that customer might be worth to you 10 times what it costs you to make the sale. But if your payback period for the sale, the time it takes you to bring in as much money as it costs you to make the sale, if that's, say, 18 months, that's an incredibly capital-hungry business model. That's either going to scale very slowly or it's going to suck in a lot of capital, because each sale, you've got to wait 18 months before you're paid back for that. If you want to grow by having more salespeople, you've got to invest capital up front. So there's a whole bunch of these metrics, software as a service metrics. There are third-party reports and surveys, and it's a whole industry now. But we do look carefully at all of those things to try to ascertain the health and potential of a business.
So,
and then if they get a little bit older,
go ahead, keep going. Yeah.
I was like, the other thing that, and I'm still learning, I love this journey that I'm on, I'm still learning, as they get bigger, you also start having to measure the softer metrics, the more of the qualitative stuff. So one of the things where, at times we've had some sharp learnings is around assessing your staff churn rates. Once it's a bit large, 40, 50 people, staff churn rates, and whether they're people effectively being fired or that you've lost, breaking down those two buckets and measuring them ongoing is a critical indicator of business health and culture, because it's easy to underestimate how much of the real value of the business is in the people who have learned the processes and acquired skills. People who sort of staff their promoter scores. On the consumer side, there's all the reputational stuff about your user and supplier net promoter scores. So all those qualitative things start becoming more and more important as the business grows.
On the flip side, what are one or two of the most glaring mistakes that you see founders making as they look for investment?
One of them we've mentioned already, and that's overselling it. You need to sound like an adult. So somebody that comes in and says, look, we started a business in Australia 2 months ago. We've got $600 a month of revenue, and invest in us because look at the potential in America, as the example we gave before, look at the potential in Europe. I think it's probably shooting themselves in the foot. I think you need to be... you need to get the balance right between showing your enthusiasm for a vision on the one hand and having a serious and mature understanding of the steps that you need to get there and the hurdles involved, and business plans that show revenue multiplying fourfold every year for the next 5 years. I tend to be pie in the sky and false anyway. But B, you probably shoot yourself in the foot going up with a plan like that, even if you think you can achieve it. So having that balance between a sense of conviction and vision and enthusiasm, but then tempered with a hard-nosed dose of, I know the steps to take, I know the time they take, the cost in money and personal effort and delay in taking those steps. A typical example of novices will make, and you'll see a business plan that will say, okay, so the business plan says 2 months from today, we bank $2 million of VC money. And next month, our payroll's gone up. Our headcount has gone from 8 to 16. That's a sign of real immaturity, because in a real world, especially if we're talking about recruiting in Australia, it will take you months to recruit people. And they've often got, you've got a job specs, search process, interviews, offers. You find one, then they've got a notice period often, and then every third or fourth one begs after agreeing to come on board. So there's a greenness that some people have in their business plans, or the greenness that some people have, which is reflected in their business plans. Oh, this month we get the money, next month we have the headcount, for example. And these are some of the common mistakes.
Is that a bigger problem with younger founders who probably just haven't had as much business experience and aren't aware of, you know, just haven't really thought through the practicalities of things like how long it takes to actually recruit somebody?
Yeah, so much is experience related, and experience is often age related. Age is not the only factor, but obviously there's a relationship there. But again, that's something we can help with. It's none of this is necessarily a deal breaker. You're asking for some of the interesting common errors and telltale signs. That's one of them.
Les, have you got a favourite company that you've invested into?
Slightly annoys my colleagues in the VC fund. I refer to them all as my children, and you shouldn't have favourites. I'm happy to talk about one or two examples, but not necessarily as favourites. Look, what are some of the things that have got me excited at the moment? RESD is doing for tours and activities what sites like, businesses like SiteMinder did for hotel room bookings starting 12, 13, 14 years ago. This provision of technology to digitise inventory, which is a precondition to them being able to distribute it internationally through your own website and third-party websites. And it improves all your, obviously, operational efficiency. You're not mucking around. Take the whale-watching example again. You operate at, three or four whale-watching boats and different cruises on different days with different prices. The ability to do that digitally gives you huge operational efficiency savings. Load on top of that the ability to distribute internationally from your office in Katoomba. That's very powerful. It's a model we understand really, really well. And RESD now, I think only about 30% of our revenue comes to Australia, New Zealand. It's already international. We've got a couple of offices in the US. What's really growing now, our original core business, we started with the booking software inventory management. In the last 12 months, we've been starting to scale very rapidly in the distribution because we now have enough digital inventory to do that, to interest the big resellers. So they've got a link, for example, to bookings.com. And that's a really exciting business because that one, again, has that medium to longer term unicorn potential. The addressable market is there. It's a market leader. It's established in the States with two small offices. So we'll probably be raising a round from the US VC funds next year, 6 or 9 months from now. And that's always exciting because the American is always a zero to everything we do. That's one example. I'll give you others if you like.
No, I think that's a great example of the kinds of things that kind of get you juiced as you're looking at companies to invest into. Les, I was also keen to get your thoughts on companies that might only operate in the home country, but actually international in the sense that they use staff and resources from offshore. Have you, got some remarks about that or some things that you think can work well there or some examples of when that's not a great option for a company to use an offshore model?
Yeah, look, I'm a huge fan and advocate of using international resources for a number of reasons. It's obviously everyone's attracted by the potential labour saving cost. But in addition to that, there's the opportunity to do 7x24 operations and the opportunity to ramp up staff numbers much more quickly than you could in Australia. For example, in tech, Australia is, especially Sydney and Melbourne, incredibly difficult to find good people and keep good people because the labour market's so competitive. So it's not just about expense saving. The whole raft of advantages or potential advantages in using offshore resources. I find it's interesting. People psychologically seem to be either tuned into that or not. We've got companies, by way of example, I'm personally invested in a tiny little thing called SnapRevise. It's got 5 or 6 people in the UK. Its CTO is in Australia. It's a Vietnamese gentleman. And they've got a tech team of 4 full-time people in Vietnam. And it actually works really well. And then in addition to that, they've got freelancers in, I think, three different countries. So a tiny company, people think about offshoring and outsourcing as big banks and insurance companies, but in our experience, very, very small companies really get a big leg up from it if they use it the right way from an early stage. And also startups, I guess by definition, I mentioned before, we tend to deal with young people and entrepreneurial people, so they have a greater affinity to doing that. They see the opportunity and work out how to do it rather than older, larger organisations that straight away think about the risks and the obstacles. There are three basic models we see, just to mention that as well, because it's not one size fits all. You've got anything from the sort of ODesk freelancer model where you just recruit and pay someone online, entirely online, as a freelancer. You've got, and they work directly for you pretty much. You've got the serviced office model, where there are third-party services. Philippines is probably biggest in this market, where they will provide the office infrastructure and handle the sort of timesheets, payment management, but they're your employees. So it's a sort of a, you outsource the compliance side of it, but they're your employees. And then the third model is you set up your own office offshore. And all three models work and are appropriate in different circumstances.
Les, it's been great to have you on the show today, and it's been fantastic to hear some of your insights around investing and things that founders should or shouldn't do. Have you got any final thoughts for people who are listening to this show and are thinking about whether they should try to take their company global or, you know, into a couple of international markets?
Well, I talked a bit about the profiles of different companies. I guess the main thing I would say is, you know, work out which of those three profiles is really you, to what extent you really have something that is transportable with very low incremental cost or effort. And if you do fit in that category of things that can be international right at the beginning, like where's the like SiteMinder, the next difficult question then is when do you actually start marketing internationally as opposed to locally? It's easy to do with SEO, SEM, but again, there's a cost and so forth. When do you start marketing internationally? And then when do you put an office on the ground offshore? And they're critical questions. And often, as I say, if you have international customers from day one, that decision to start specifically marketing to, say, UK customers may come in year two or three, and then putting an office on the ground, again, may come in year three or four, typically. It varies a lot.
Thanks so much. Great to have you on the show.
Thanks for making it easy.
If you're enjoying the Business Beyond Borders podcast and you're thinking about expanding your company internationally, check out the Dearen & Associates website, dearenassociates.com. Our consulting services, which include market research and modeling, cross-cultural consulting, and strategic business connections, deliver deep insights and create value for larger companies looking to scale internationally. If you're from a smaller organization that wants to expand its global footprint, take a look at our International Business Accelerator Program, which my team and I created to help micro to medium-sized businesses to speed up and de-risk the process of going global. The program helps business owners to build a great strategy without having to reinvent the wheel. It creates the momentum to put the strategy into play, and it helps them to generate or raise the funds that they need to get an international expansion off the ground. We built it especially for founders and CEOs who want to take their business to the next level and wondering where to start. It's structured in a way that's simple to follow. It's digital so that you can take part from anywhere in the world. It's a lot of fun and our members love it. Check it out at dearenassociates.com.